Welcome, my friends, to the Generations Radio broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host with you. I'm a homeschool father of five, raising my children out here in the eastern plains of Colorado during the demise of Western civilization. And we are a safe distance from the demise of Western civilization out here on the eastern plains of Colorado. In my basement, we've been broadcasting on this program to 80 to 90, maybe 100 countries around the world for the last 10 years. And Dave Buhner is also in studio with me, another homeschooling dad. And friends, our economic system is not doing well, and we've talked about this. Now, it appears that there has been somewhat of a recovery, but not very much. The recovery itself has been anemic, and unlike other recoveries in other recessions since the Great Depression of 1929. So it appears that we are not seeing much of a recovery. I've got an interesting piece from David Stockman coming up in just a moment.
Doesn't recovery mean that somebody's doing better than they were?
That's the idea, right, right. And if the median income is 8% lower than it was before the recession, right now, Dave, that indicates we have not recovered entirely from the median income decrease in America, which means the average family in America is doing worse than they were in 2007, okay. And that has not experienced ending of recovery after, what, 5 years of Barack Obama and the administration that has been spending more money than any president since
ever. Yes.
Ever, right.
So that's the average family. But who's recovering? Because I hear about a recovery. Where is it?
Dave, I don't know. I don't know if I can trust the unemployment numbers. The unemployment numbers are supposed to be slightly better, like 7.9 versus 8.1%.
Right.
Just slightly. Remember when unemployment used to be like 4%?
Right, and people had good
and
jobs.
And now they're saying, you know, unemployment is 0.2% lower than it was. We're down to 7.9%. Must be a recovery. I'm not seeing it, Dave. Not seeing it in gas prices, not seeing it in median incomes, not seeing it in cost of living, not seeing it, you know, on and on. I'm just not seeing it. Now, I think we have more reason to be concerned than ever before on a global economic scale. You know what's going on in Cyprus right now.
Right, right.
We're confiscating people's money in Cyprus, Dave.
Yeah, we used to call it stealing. I think I know where the recovery is. The stock market is way high.
Yeah, everybody's betting on the recovery. That's all that is. All that is the people just betting on the fact that we have recovered. That isn't the recovery.
Oh.
That's betting on the fact that we have recovered. But the problem is we have not recovered.
Some stocks have recovered.
That's right. Some stocks have recovered because people are rather optimistic. They're feeling a little bullish about the bearish market.
Okay.
If feeling they can bullish about the bearish market. Yeah.
Okay.
That's the problem. Is there is a bit of over-optimism going on in the stock market right now, meaning that, and Dave, I don't understand why gold has slipped about $300 per ounce in the last couple of 4 or 5 months. Now, I realize a lot of that's manipulated, so who knows why. But why in the world should gold slip another, what, 50, 60 bucks over the last week at the same time we're getting all this news from Cyprus? You would think that people would not be trusting the banks, would not be trusting their 401ks, their IRAs to the banks or to the IRA accounts when you've got what's going on in Cyprus. Here's a Human Events article 3 days ago, Cyprus meltdown, asset seizure to hit 50, 60, or maybe even 100%.
But that's not for the people who had a lot of money, who got it out of the banks before this all blew up.
There's always somebody who's ahead of everybody else. You're right. But this is like musical chairs, and they remove like 16 chairs, and 16 people aren't going to have a chair at the end of it.
Right. But there's people who have lots of money who got the tip, you know, and that's the way it works. When you see something in Cyprus, ask who benefited and who lost. And you'll see that once again, we have a transfer of wealth from the working class to a few of the elites. That's what's happening in Cyprus. By the way, it's happening here. It's happening everywhere. The question is, how cloaked and how veiled is the process?
Okay, this is Human Events from a couple of days ago. You may recall that the island Republic of Cyprus needed to come up with $10 billion or so in fast money in order to meet the European Union's requirements for massive emergency loans. The government of Cyprus originally planned to do this by seizing part of the balance in every bank account in the country, 6.7% for the little guy, 9.9% for wealthy depositors. This proved both politically unworkable. No plan constructed by any socialist-leaning government on earth can involve the little guy having skin in the game, and a dangerous violation of European Union deposit insurance, which is supposed to guarantee the first 100,000 euros of every bank account. The Cypriotic legislature shot down the broad-based asset seizure plan with a unanimous vote, according to Reuters. The decision was based in part on a belief that the Russians could be prevailed upon for alternative financing to the tune of 5 billion euros in new loans, plus better repayment terms in Cyprus's outstanding balance of $2.5 billion. Anyway, it goes on, and it says the BBC is quoted as saying it might end up being more like 60% or maybe even 100% confiscation. Right now, the plan is right around 15%. And so, friends, it looks like the what's happening in Cyprus is very, very dangerous. And, Dave, the same sort of thing could happen in other countries as well. I can't imagine it not happening in other countries, especially while governments are wanting to preserve themselves, and they will always preserve themselves, and who cares what happens to the investors in these banks.
Well, you know, we have the two classes right now. We have the too big to fail and the too small to count. And right now, the too small to count is always funding the too big to fail. When you have somebody getting in the middle of a free exchange of goods and services and regulating it, you have somebody picking winners and losers. And the reason the winners are picked is because they have people in powerful places that help pick them. And they keep themselves that way. They have an interest in staying on top. Billionaires don't like to lose billions of dollars. That's why they're billionaires.
Mm-hmm. Okay, David Stockman has an interesting piece in the New York Times. And, Dave, amazing for a number of reasons. Number one, it is New York Times. New York Times is one of the most liberal newspapers in America. And at the same time, David Stockman is one of the most conservative guys from the Ronald Reagan administration. I remember him appointed by Ronald Reagan in 1980. He was a cabinet member. I can't remember exactly what part he played there. But David Stockman has an opinion piece in the New York Times, and it's a good summary of where we're at, friends. Here's the title, State Wrecked, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. The Dow Jones and Standard Poor's 500 indexes reached record highs on Thursday, having completed erased losses since the stock market's last peak in 2007. But instead of cheering, we should be very afraid. And that was the point you just made. Okay, and it goes on and on. Dave, this is an amazing summary of what is going on right now in American economics, friends. Oh, man. Over the last 13 years, the stock market has twice crashed, touched off a recession. American households lost $5 trillion in the 2000-dot-com bust and more than $7 trillion in the 2007 housing crash. Sooner or later, within a few years, I predict this latest Wall Street bubble, inflated by an egregious flood of phony money from the Federal Reserve rather than real economic gains, will explode too. What he's saying is, this is David Stockman, friends, a big-time economist who was working with Ronald Reagan back in the 1980s. David Stockman is saying, man, this economy, this stock market, ain't going to continue. Since the S&P 500 first reached its current level in March of 2000, in other words, it took us 14 years to get back to where we were in 2000. Now, that in itself is interesting, Dave. The stock market fell in 2000. Now, 14 years later, we've finally achieved the point at which the stock market was resting in 2000, 14 years ago. And what he's saying is, it's all smoke and mirrors, friends, all smoke and mirrors. In March of 2000, the mad money printers at the Federal Reserve have expanded their balance sheet sixfold to $3.2 trillion from $500 billion. It's sixfold. That's 600% for those of you who are interested in hyperbolic numbers. Another hyperbolic number. Okay, yet during that stretch, economic output has grown by an average of 1.7% a year, the slowest since the Civil War. The worst, we say, is we had the worst decade, Dave, since the Civil War.
Yep.
And that would have been back in 1965.
The Civil War?
Yeah.
No, 1865.
Okay, just getting our numbers straight in here. We're just testing you on that.
You knew I went to public school.
Yeah, I did.
You thought you could do that to me.
I was testing you. Yeah. Okay, friends, it's the worst decade. The worst decade for America in 150 years. All right, this is called the decline of Western civilization. All right, for those of you who are wondering if Kevin Swanson gets a little hyperbolic in his basement,
he definitely gets hyper.
He gets hyper. But is he hyperbolic? That's the question at hand. Okay, we have just come out of the worst decade since 1865, in 150 years. In other words, America did very well in the Industrial Revolution. This is what we're saying. In the Industrial Revolution, where we began to mechanize, we began to centralize, we began to automate, we began to computerize. Okay, we actually did a lot of technology. Technology did a lot for the economy. There's no question about it. I've got refrigerators. I've got freezers. I've got cars. I've got automated heating systems. I've got all kinds of neat things thanks to the Industrial Revolution. Industrial Revolution did something for the economy. The fact is, friends, we're done with that. We're through with whatever the Industrial Revolution can buy us. We've used up our character. We certainly used up our capital. We're spending it, our grandkids and our great-grandkids into debt right now. We're done for, okay? We've used up whatever industrialization we could squeeze out of industrialization. And now here we are, 150 years after the Civil War, after all that Industrial Revolution, and we have the worst decade in 150 years. We're going down, baby. This thing's going down. Not much more that industry can do for us, Dave. I mean, haven't we exported most industry anyway?
Well, we're not doing industry, and that's industry means to work and to take dominion. We're not taking work. We're not doing work.
70% of young men are playing computer games while Rome burns.
I'm not going to even blame it on the young men. I think we have a systemic issue. Look, there are four different ways that one can attain wealth. An entity or a person, a family can attain wealth. One is you can do it passively. In other words, you can inherit it. Maybe a great uncle dies and gives you some money. You find a $100 bill on the sidewalk. Okay, that doesn't produce wealth in the overall economy. That's just a redistribution of wealth. So there's nothing happening in terms of dominion there, but somebody's acquired some wealth. The second way is production. Now, production is what God told us to do. He said, go out and produce things.
Work.
Take dominion.
Work.
Right, work. Yeah. Now, that can be a good or a service. That always increases the size of the economy. So the economy has a certain size, but you go take some dirt out of the ground, you form it into something that now has more value that somebody will trade something for, and now the economy's grown by the difference of what the dirt was worth to what the dirt that's been reshaped is worth, or the log that's cut down, or the house that's built, or whatever. But then there's two other ways. One is coercion. This is the confiscation of money. Usually by claiming authority over somebody who has the money. This is what governments do.
This happens a lot. Governments are very good at this kind of thing.
Right, and governments are so good at it, they want to trick you into thinking it's voluntary. Like, for instance, the IRS says to you, well, filing your taxes is voluntary. It is. And if you don't volunteer to do it, they'll take all your wealth away and put you in prison. But it's voluntary.
Right.
Being drafted was voluntary. Paying your property taxes is voluntary, but that's all coercive. It's not very much different than when the mob comes in and says, boy, this is a nice place. It would be a shame if it burned down. I think you should get some insurance. It's a voluntary exchange, but it's coercive. And the fourth, of course, is theft. And that's the pure stealing of money, taking it away by force from people who already have it. Now, our governments not only are good at coercion, but right now they're very good at theft, and they're so good at this, most people don't realize it's happening. There's another economic principle that's important here. The finite supply of value at any given moment in a market is important, otherwise you wouldn't have reason to do trade. If you had everything you needed, you wouldn't need to trade for anything. So there's a finite value, and we create a means of exchange called money, and it doesn't matter whether or not there's a billion pounds of gold or 1 million pounds of gold. As long as that amount of gold is somewhat fixed, we can mine more, but it is finite. If we take all the gold on the planet that ever was, that would be a finite amount. Now, that's how money is supposed to work. It's not invented by a government. It's a human institution because it makes sense, but it's not government made. And that's an important aspect here. When our Federal Reserve System creates money, they don't do it because they found more gold. They just say there's more money. Now, when you say there's more money, it dilutes the value of everything else. So let's say I wanted to buy a cow from you, and I was willing to pay you 4 pigs. But it turns out that 4 pigs for your cow isn't worthwhile because the neighbor has 4,000 pigs, and he just wants to get rid of 4. You won't sell me because now there's more pigs in the marketplace. So when the Federal Reserve creates more wealth, they inflate or they increase the price of everything. And now the words of Rudyard Kipling, Rudyard Kipling really ring true, that there was plenty of money, but nothing that money could buy. So our stock prices are at an all-time high, but the value in the marketplace is at an all-time low. People aren't working. There's a coercive redistribution of wealth, but we're not producing more wealth.
And that's really, I think, what Stockman is saying in this piece from the New York Times. I mean, he summarizes it, friends, by saying, hey, we're not expanding our productivity. Our productivity, economic output, has grown by an average of 1.7% per year, the slowest since the Civil War. Real business investment has crawled forward at only 0.8% per year. The payroll job count has crept up at a negligible 0.1% annually. Real median family income growth has dropped 8%, and we said that earlier. And the number of full-time middle-class jobs, 6%. So we have 6% drop in the number of full-time middle-class jobs. And my guess is the population of America has not declined in the last 14 years. But the number of middle-class full-time jobs has decreased by 6%. The real net worth of the bottom 90% has dropped by one-fourth. And the number of food stamps and disability aid recipients has more than doubled to 59 million. And we have said that a number of times. To the point now where the majority of Americans are on some form of welfare, Social Security, or food stamps at this point. And when you hit that number, friends, productivity is out the window. All right? Now, this is the way it wraps up the story. David Stockman, is he being hyperbolic? Is he being over-depressed as he gives this article, this opinion piece in the New York Times? This dyspeptic prospect results from the fact that we are now state-wrecked. With only brief interruptions, we have had 8 decades of increasingly frenetic fiscal and monetary policy activism intended to counter the cyclical bumps and grinds of the free market and its purported tendency to underproduce jobs and economic output. The toll has been heavy. He says these policies have brought America to an end-stage metastasis. That is, it's metastasized. This is the end-stage metastasis. This is where the blood starts to flow freely. This is where we're done for. He says, the way out would be so radical, it can't happen. It can't happen. It would necessitate a sweeping divorce of the state and the market economy. It would require a renunciation of crony capitalism and its first cousin, Keynesian economics, in all its forms. Okay, so there it is, friends. David Stockman, one of the most important economic figures, economist in American history, working for the Ronald Reagan administration in the New York Times, a mainstream publication, a liberal publication. He is a conservative commentator from the Reagan Revolution. And has he overstated the case? He's basically saying the good times are over. And by the way, we've been saying that for the last 5 to 10 years. We've been giving people the heads up. Whatever socioeconomic system we've gotten from John Maynard Keynes, the homosexual, and the social system we got from Margaret Sanger and Karl Marx and everybody else and all of the public schools that have been socializing education for the last 100 years, that system is ruining our country. And here we are today cruising into the wall, and there's nothing that can stop us except perhaps divine intervention. Now, he's saying, Dave, there are some things we can do. He says we could do some things. We could do drastic deflation of the realm of politics. That is, you know, take government, slash it by 80%. The abolition of incumbency itself, because the machinery of the state, the machinery of reelection have become conterminous. He says, also prying them apart would entail sweeping constitutional surgery, amendments to give the president and members of the Congress a single 6-year term, no reelection, providing 100% public financing for candidates, strictly limiting the duration of campaigns, prohibiting for life lobbying by anyone who has been on legislative or executive payroll, on and on and on. Dave, and I'm going to say that these are not going to be effective. Even this would not be effective.
No, it wouldn't. It's trying to cure cancer with 1,000 Band-Aids.
Oh, man. And he's saying, okay, we are at the end. At the end of America, at the end of the free market system, and really the American productivity we have enjoyed over 150 years. Dave, I've used this illustration before. It's, you know, sometimes we prognosticate on this program. Now, you can't prophesy the end of a nation, the end of a system, without saying, yeah, but there could be supernatural intervention. Something could somehow salvage everything. But if you saw a 747 tumbling out of the sky, Dave, tumbling end over end out of the sky, and you would say, I think that thing is going to crash. But you'd probably want to say, short of divine intervention, short of Superman flying in and grabbing the thing and landing it safely in a field, if a 747 was tumbling out of the sky, tumbling out of the sky, you'd probably say, that thing's going to crash.
Right.
That would be your only conclusion to the matter.
Right.
Now, that's the way I look at the American economy. It's a 747, and it's taking a tumble. And short of divine intervention and some kind of massive reformational system, a complete reviving in the hearts of hundreds of millions of Americans, this thing's coming down, friends. This thing's coming down. Now, the solutions happen to be moral, character-oriented, faith-related, and that's what Stockman forgets to mention. He separates the social, the moral, from the economic, and of course that can never be done. Problem with Americans is they're just existentialistic to the core, and they could care less what happens to the kids and grandkids. Hey, they've aborted a third of them. They've killed, you know, 50, 60, 80 million of them. So if you've killed 80 million kids, and you're running your grandkids and your great-grandkids into debt, really no surprise here at all. Problem with Stockman is he doesn't bring in the moral element of this kind of thing. And he doesn't say, hey, the fact that you have 10 times the Shackup rate, the fact that you have most of the kids born to young people 30 years of age and younger out of wedlock is an indication that this nation is living off of previous capital. And we're not going to survive as a nation in the years to come. Dave, the radical change of heart, the radical change that's needed. He says the way out would be so radical, it can't happen. What's radical is a change of heart, a change of moral compass. We used to call it repentance. And that's what's got to happen here.
It does. And you know, I like Stockman in that he is somewhat of an Austrian economist. And unlike the Keynesian economists who tried an experiment based on what they want reality to look like, they hoped reality would work this way. The Austrian school tried to observe and make scientific evaluations of what did happen. But one of the tenets of the Austrian school of economics is that human behavior drives economics, and economics drives human behavior. And the human behavior aspect here, the social component, Stockton is missing. One of the things, one of the big revolutionary happenings that I believe history will record here, is that we went from a massive continental drift, a shift from a household economy with a united family that had solidarity. Adam Smith, Wealth of Nations, speaks of this quite well. And we've gone to a different kind of economy based on individual stores of wealth. Your wife has a bank account, you have a bank account, and we've moved to a corporate/government economy, where the government and the corporations work hand in hand, hand in glove with each other. They feed off of each other. The corporations write the legislation. The legislation passes the bills that benefit the corporation, and the corporations keep the guys who pass the bill in office. So we have that kind of corruption going on. But the motion of wealth from the individual, from the family, into the corporation has never happened on this scale before, with the 401ks and the IRAs. Mm-hmm. And I'm afraid, Kevin, that what's really going on here is an elaborate scheme to defraud America, an elaborate scheme to get people who think they're saving. But we know Keynesians don't like savings. They think that's money not working. They think they're saving. They're putting it into a stock that's tax-deferred or tax-exempt, an IRA of some sort. And what's really could be happening is that some of these very large brokerage houses, in cooperation with the government and the government protection scheme, are working to get people to move their capital into stocks, inflating the cost of the stock, so people get the perception that they're making money. And at a certain point, these big houses start betting short on the market. And then when the stock tumbles, which it must tumble, who benefits? The stockhouse, right. the big financial institution who made money on the way up, made money on the way down, who lost. The little guy who thought he was savings.
Right.
I'm afraid that this is an elaborate scheme. Yeah.
It's going to impoverish America. Dave, any way you look at it, it's going to impoverish this country. And the goal, of course, is to place everybody on government welfare so that everybody's living in some dive somewhere funded by the government to the tune of $67 a month. And they'll just starve to death on the
government
dime.
Which is just a nice way of saying everybody becomes a slave of the elites.
Yeah. Okay, friends. The solution, of course, being a biblical socioeconomic system. The solution, of course, being let's get back to family-based economies. The unhealthy, unholy coalition between capitalists and the government always forms this socialist alliance that will impoverish the nation, destroy the middle class, and destroy many, many, many families in the process. Now, of course, part of the goal is to find some disintegration for the family to make sure that dad gets his job and the mom gets her job and little Missy gets her little college education so she can be fragmented out of the family herself with her little career job. And then, of course, the little boy is still playing video games at 30 years of age, and he's not even a factor in the economy. So that's pretty much where things are going right now. But we're suggesting family-based economies. Let's get back to family-integrated economies. It's a highly decentralized form of an economic system that is really as old as the earth, and we find it all the way through Scripture, including Proverbs 31, where the heart of her husband safely trusts in her so that he shall have no need to spoil. The assumption, of course, being that there is a unified family economy, and that husband and that wife are working together. Now, granted, our slave state system is not very helpful in keeping the family economy together. And so what you get is the fascist corporations largely regulated and controlled by governments, and the insurance programs largely provided by governments, provided on an individual basis to the man or to the woman. And more, there will be a separation between the man and the woman thanks to these corporate Benny packages and thanks to the government social welfare programs that will ultimately be, I think, totally socialized in the years to come, unless families opt out by way of Samaritan Ministries and the Christian Medical Sharing Ministries and the family economies that are largely based in small businesses, that are largely based in entrepreneurial-based businesses. As we build this kind of economy, we hopefully will be able to opt ourselves out of the socialist systems that are inherently family fragmenting, and inherently they drive young ladies into the single status where they are more and more dependent upon the state and not dependent upon their husbands. Dave, does that pretty much summarize it? I've got a story here. I'm going to read in just a moment how way more American women are shacking up than did in 2004 and right. In 1995. So the socio element of this as important as the economic element.
Yeah, the behavior element, the human behavior element. And of course, behavior flows from the heart of a man. So that's why we call for repentance. We call for a change of the heart that we might get a change of actions, and a change of actions will change societies. Look, two visions for society. One, a family economic unit. The husband and the wife work together like an axe head and an axe handle. They take dominion. Now, the benefits of this is the woman is cared for. The man has incentive to work hard because he's going to pass his children, his wealth one day. He's going to give them the means of production, the capital. He's going to give them a upbringing. He's going to train them. They're going to take on that family name. He's got great pride in that. So the man is encouraged to work harder, his wife to stay with him and be protected, his children to take over. Now, here's another vision. This is the current vision. A man is encouraged not to get married because if he gets married, he's probably going to get divorced. And if he gets divorced, he's going to end up paying alimony, child support, maintenance, whatever the current thing is. He's got no incentive then to work hard. He might as well get a job at McDonald's so he doesn't have to pay the old shrew some extra money because he's not getting any benefit from her. She's always looking for the next bigger score, the next bigger guy who can pay her more. If she has children, that's her choice. But she's not going to have children until she's 30. And she may have had two dozen lovers before that because, you know, she's always trying to find the next big money pocket. And she kind of likes bad boys anyway. But she's completely independent from the man. Only getting together to sucker him into this union, which she can, you know, benefit from. But because that's not very dependable, she's always going to vote for the bigger husband, which is the government, to make sure that her health care and her child care and her food stamps are provided.
And that's why the largest socialist voting bloc in America is single women. That's why Barack Obama is president of the United States. Please understand, if it wasn't for single women, half of households in America run by single women. If it wasn't for that, Barack Obama would not be president of the United States. So it does no good for David Stockman to say, well, you know, we could fix things by limiting terms, and we could fix things if we just decrease the size of government. I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. As long as you have a massive, massive number of women shacking up and not getting married in their 20s. Okay, here's healthdaynews.com. Many, many American women are living with their partners rather than tying the knot, a new government survey finds. Apparently, the government survey is funded by the National Center for Health Statistics, part of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And Dave, this is the shocking thing about it. Just between 2006 and 2010, that almost 50% of American women cohabiting outside of marriage, about half. That's significant. I'm going to say why in just a moment. But it's compared to 43% in 2002 and 34% in 1995. That is what we're looking at is, again, the exponential hyperbole coming up out of the functions, the X squared function happening here, friends, with the shack-up rate. The report was based on in-person interviews with more than 12,000 women. One reason more people are living together is a well-documented delay in the age at which people are marrying. That's a no-brainer. Yeah, they put it off, so they have to shack up and do their sex outside of marriage because they're putting off marriage as long as possible. The reason they do that, of course, is because of the college vision, because of the career vision, because there is no family economic idea. There is very little mentorship going on with young men anyway, and young men are playing video games while Rome burns. Many of these arrangements occur at a young age, with one quarter of women cohabiting by age 20. Incredible. Before age 20, about 25% of women are already cohabiting. Okay, my friends. Well, anyway, the story goes on and on. The 50% mark is important and significant because that's the point at which the majority of society has become dysfunctional. Okay? The majority of society is becoming dysfunctional. If 50% of kids are born out of wedlock to young women under age 30, and you have 50% of young ladies cohabiting, that puts the entire nation in the point of dysfunctionality. When you get the majority doing that, then the majority is giving birth to the majority, which gives birth to the majority, and you're in the vicious circle that will destroy an entire civilization. And forget what David Stockman says. There's no way to salvage the economic system as long as we are not salvaging the part of the socioeconomic system. So David Stockman is not going to see this nation improve anytime too soon unless, of course, there is repentance. Unless, of course, there is an occasional person who is able to glob onto a little bit of the life raft and they're able to somehow repent in the micro. The micros will be doing just fine, friends. As this whole thing fractures, as we see the decentralization, as we see the Titanic breaking up, there will be life rafts because there have been a life raft manufacturing center, much like our family economics program, our family economics conferences, there will be that. And we will see healthy, integrated families who are getting a vision from the Word of God concerning the way that you run family, concerning the way that you run your economic systems. And there will be families out of debt because they said, forget about the whole macro system. We're transferring our IRAs, our 401ks, into paying off our debts. We are moving all of these assets into paying off these debts. We are going to be debt-free, which is exactly what I did back in the early 1990s, and that's how I paid off the first $40,000 little trailer on 18 acres in Grants Pass, Oregon. That's how we did it early on, unless there are tens of millions of families paying off their debts, their mortgages, and going debt-free and not living off of their grandkids and great-grandkids in terms of their debt. Unless we begin to see family inheritance saved up, hopefully by way of hard metals and real estate paid off, et cetera, et cetera. Unless we begin to see some sense amongst the micros, there will be no life rafts off of this Titanic. However, I'm really happy. I'm actually ecstatic that our movements are growing in leaps and bounds, friends. I'm telling you, the life raft manufacturing centers are booming on the deck of the Titanic as we approach the iceberg. Things are going pretty good, actually. Things are going pretty good. I'm in a really good mood. Why? Because I'm not about the macro. I'm about the micro. And that's why we do our family economics conferences, two this year, one on the West Coast, one over in Missouri. And friends, if you're anywhere near, if you're a day's drive away from St. Louis, Missouri, or a day's drive away from Washington State, you need to be at our family economics conferences this year. We are talking about salvaging entire socioeconomic systems, but it will be in the micros. And those conferences, of course, being held this year, and registration is open now, although my understanding is we are filling up fast, especially for the St. Louis, Missouri, but also the Washington conference is filling up extremely fast, faster right now than the other one. But if you want to be a part of these conferences, check it out at familyeconomics.com. Again, that address is familyeconomics.com for any information you want on our family economics conferences. I'm excited about what's happening with the reintegrated family in the 21st century. We've got ideas. Now, granted, these are not the only ideas, okay? There are other people doing other things, so we're not saying we're the only ones working on reintegrating the Christian biblical family and the family economy in the 21st century. But friends, we're doing it. And we would like to invite you to some of our conferences. Again, we're doing some of the similar things in New Zealand and Australia. So for some of you who are interested in some of these ideas and you want to find ways to launch these lifeboats in Australia and New Zealand, we will be there in June as well. I think we've got a 10-day tour, four conferences in New Zealand and Australia coming up June, I think it's May 30th to June 12th. And for more information there, you need to go to ncfic.org. That's ncfic.org, the National Center for Family Integrated Churches. And we are going to have some exciting conferences in Australia and New Zealand, as well as Washington State and St. Louis, Missouri this year. For more information, friends, familyeconomics.com or ncfic.org. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down the vision for the next generation.
Every year, Generations with Vision sponsors a family economics conference somewhere in America. This year, we are sponsoring two conferences, one in Washington State and the other in St. Louis, Missouri. For families who want to reintegrate the family into a family economic vision, for families who want to find ways to mentor their sons and daughters into the family economy, this is just the conference for you. How do you choose the optimum business dreams for your family? How do you integrate your children into the family economy? What about budgets and debt and capital investments? And what about inheritance and taking care of grandpa and grandma along the way? We'll have young entrepreneur panels, mom and daughter panels, farming panels, retail and e-commerce panels, audience surveys, and some great keynote speakers, including free-range farmer Joel Salatin, entrepreneur Eric Weir, and Kevin Swanson. Join us for our four-day mega conference in St. Louis or the two-day fall conference in Olympia, Washington. Register today at familyeconomics.com. That's familyeconomics.com.